Now, for many children of the 1980s, what we're going to talk about next is Sacrilege. A new version of Footloose opens in theaters today with no Kevin Bacon in sight. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan compares the old with the new.
As long as daughters pout when fathers proclaim, "I don't want you to see that boy," Footloose will endure. As long as kids want to dance and Hollywood wants to profit from that passion, it will do more than endure. It will be remade.
What's the deal with the preacher's daughter?
The new version of the 1984 epic about a small town that bans youthful dancing is not so much a remake as a renovation. In the great tradition of Los Angeles real estate, a venerable property has been modernized, refurbished, and tweaked when necessary to bring it in line with the demands of today's market. That means that the clothes are tighter, the bodies more toned, the dancing hotter, the sexual context more obvious. But underneath it all still beats the shameless heart of a by-the-numbers diversion that acts as if these dots have never been connected before. Young Ren arrived in the small town of Beaumont with his mom in the 1984 version, but the updated edition ups the emotional ante by bringing him in parentless to live in the South with his aunt and uncle. The town's authority figures are soon up in arms about the youth's Yankee sarcasm. But he looks about as dangerous as pasteurized milk.
I know, but I think he's cute.
Ren makes fast friends with local boy Willard. And once he settles down, he doesn't know what's harder to believe. That someone as attractive as preacher's daughter Ariel is in town, or that he's not allowed to dance with her.
Are you kidding me? Dancing is against the law.
The old and new Footloose are so similar, entire scenes and lines of dialogue appear in both films. And iconic objects like a yellow VW bug, a maroon dinner jacket, and fire red cowboy boots, who doesn't remember those boots, reappear as if by magic to reassure the faithful that all's right with the world. As hormones rage and familiar songs like Footloose and Holding Out for a Hero get an updated treatment, it's hard not to wonder what the next remake might be like. Will there be a next one? You can count on it.
Got to stay faithful to the classics. Ken Turan reviews movies for the LA Times and for Morning Edition. Morning Edition is directed by Leah Scarpelli and Lindsay Totte. Our production staff includes Nishant Dahiya, Jess Gittner, Asma Khalid, Travis Larchuk, Kevin Leahy, Lauren McGaughey, Steve Monroe, Vince Pearson, Selena Simmons-Duffin, and Ashley Westerman. Ben Bergman and Melissa Yeager-Miller are at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sika, and the executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. The theme music was written by B.J. Lederman, arranged by Jim Pugh. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
As we've heard, President Obama said today what he has said repeatedly about the trade agreement with South Korea, that it will benefit the U.S. auto industry.
Just as Americans buy Hyundais and Kias, I hope that South Koreans will buy more Fords, Chryslers, and Chevys.
Well, reporter Eric Martin writes about this for Bloomberg News today, and the headline of his article is, "Koreans driving Chevys aren't assured by U.S. trade accord." And Eric Martin joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And first, let's acknowledge that the trade agreement with South Korea is likely to boost many U.S. exports, machinery, chemicals, plastics. But what about cars?
Cars will see some gains from this, but not nearly as much as some proponents and some supporters had hoped. We currently sell 13,000 cars, the U.S., to Korea each year versus about 600,000 Korean cars coming into the U.S. So clearly there's a big deficit in car exports, and this agreement will help some, but it doesn't change the taste of South Korean car buyers and consumers. And that is an issue that underlies a lot of the concern analysts have about making very broad and aggressive projections about how many cars will sell because of this.
But back to the president's stated desire to see folks in South Korea driving Fords and Chevys and Chryslers. There's a story in USA Today which says, and I quote, "Fords and Chryslers maybe, but folks in South Korea do drive Chevys." And it says that GM Korea is actually a very big player there already.
That's right. GM has a unit formerly known as Daewoo, which is now being branded under the GM and Chrysler brands. And so there are some consumers in South Korea who are driving cars made by them, but that's under that brand. And a lot of those cars are actually made in South Korea. They're not necessarily exported from the U.S.
Well, how important, compared to what you described, is the fairly bleak prospects for huge car sales by the American automakers exporting to South Korea? How important was this language about the automobiles to getting approval of the deal with South Korea?
The language about Ford, Chevys, and Chryslers has been the main rhetorical point that President Obama has used in talking about the agreements. When he made his speech to a joint session of Congress on September 8th, talking about his jobs proposals and this $447 billion plan that's now being debated, this was the line that he used to talk about American exports. There are many industries that will benefit actually more potentially than autos, beef, machinery, chemicals. Producers of all of those are also excited about these agreements, but the cars aspect of it has really been used as an emblem of how American ingenuity and production are going to benefit.
And it won over some important votes in Congress from Michigan, say?
It did. The Obama administration spent 2 years renegotiating parts of the CARS agreement in the South Korea Free Trade Accord. They got the ability for U.S. car manufacturers to export 25,000 vehicles a year that meet U.S. safety standards, but not the more stringent South Korean safety standards. They also got an aspect of this agreement where U.S. makers can send cars that exceed the South Korean emissions rule by up to 19%. So both of those were aspects that were renegotiated by the Obama administration and won the support of initial opponents of this agreement, which were Ford, the United Auto Workers Union, and Michigan Congressman Democrat Sander Levin. And we've also seen a reduction, a scaling back in the tariff reductions, the speed with which this change would happen, so they wouldn't face an onslaught from Kia and from Hyundai.
Well, Eric Martin, thanks a lot for talking with us about this story.
Thanks for having me on.
Eric Martin, who's global trade reporter for Bloomberg Government and Bloomberg News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Events in Alabama expose some of the conflicting interests in this country's debate over immigration. Americans are concerned about illegal immigrants, but much of the U.S. economy relies on immigrant labor. That conflict became clear in Alabama after the state approved what is considered the nation's toughest immigration law. It allows police to detain people indefinitely if they are suspected of being in the country illegally. Those rules have led to an exodus of mostly Hispanic low-wage workers. And now businesses say they're having a hard time finding replacements. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The complaints are coming from several sectors of Alabama's economy: agriculture, construction, timber, even tourism. In a large warehouse-like building in Orange Beach, a town on the Alabama Gulf Coast, about a half dozen workers wash and sort laundry. Clean towels and sheets are fed through automated folders and packed into giant bags destined for beachfront condos. Bill Brett of Brett Robinson Real Estate says the facility goes through about 2.5 million pounds of laundry a year. But in the wake of Alabama's new immigration law, he's wondering how the company will keep up.
And we've had many employees leave that were legal. Maybe a family member wasn't legal, or maybe a close friend or relative, or maybe they're just scared of being targeted and they're just uncomfortable staying in this community and working here.
Brett says finding enough workers for his housekeeping crew has always been a problem, but now it's worse than ever.
We're not getting the applications. We're desperate
The firm has been using the federal E-Verify system to make sure its workforce is legal for more than a year now, well ahead of the new state requirement. Brett says he understands the concerns about illegal immigrants, but says the new law reaches beyond them.
And I just feel like that unintentionally we're treating some of these people like they're less than human.
One worker who has remained is Jassiel, who only wants to be identified by her first name. She's worked for Brett Robinson Real Estate for 11 years. The Panama native is a naturalized U.S. citizen. She says the immigration law has struck fear throughout the Hispanic community in South Alabama, in part because of a provision that allows police to jail suspects on reasonable suspicion that they're in the country illegally.
They're scared. It is sad because they feel like they are being treated as a criminal.
All we ask is that those who live and work in our state do so legally.
That's Republican Governor Robert Bentley at a news conference yesterday announcing a new initiative called Work Alabama, a response to the mounting complaints from businesses that the new law is driving away even the legal seasonal workers they count on.
On a short-term basis, we want to match up the jobs that are available today in Alabama with the people who are looking for a job right now.
Bentley rejects the notion that unemployed Alabamians are not interested in some of the vacant jobs in the fields and laundry rooms.
I think it's almost insulting to say that people in Alabama won't do a hard day's work for a decent day's pay, and they'll do it. And all we have to do is provide them that opportunity.
Realtor Bill Brett is not so sure.
The cliches are that these people are taking American jobs, and they're not. They're taking jobs that Americans don't want for the most part. You know, we have the numbers to prove it.
Brett says on his janitorial crew, he typically loses 75% of local hires within the first month of working. He doesn't advocate repealing the state's immigration law, but says it needs to be reevaluated.
I'm about as conservative of a person as you will meet, but I feel like we've gone too far.
Jay Reed, president of Alabama Associated Builders and Contractors, hears similar concerns from his members who are worried about the climate created by the state's crackdown.
At some point, we've got to say, those that were here legally, you are welcome here.
Until then, Reed says, the state has got to find new ways to fill the worker void. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
Time now for our video pick of the week, and Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, is here. Good to see you, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have we got? Another space theme this week.
This is the perfect follow, because if you were listening to that segment thinking, what kind of experiment could I do in space? We are here to give you an awesome example, and for extra inspiration, we have a very special guest with us this week. Don Pettit is a NASA astronaut. He's logged nearly 6 months on the International Space Station, and he is the guy who gave us the video footage for our video pick this week. And I actually want to have him explain it. Hi, Don. Welcome to the program.
It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
Oh, thanks. So it has to do with eggs, but maybe you can walk us through what experiment you did in space.
Okay, well, this experiment was trying to answer space rhetorical question, a future space rhetorical question. And this has to do with future space colonists living and working in space. They're, of course, going to have their zero-gravity chickens, and they're going to be laying their eggs. And then some ornery little boy mixes hard-boiled eggs with the fresh eggs. And now you got to figure out which eggs are hard-boiled and which eggs are fresh.
What do you do?
Well, any grade school kid knows down here on Earth, if you do this, you can spin the eggs on a tabletop, and a hard-boiled egg behaves differently than a fresh egg. And so you could possibly do the same thing in a weightless environment, but the eggs are no longer confined to the tabletop. And so what is going to happen? Can you determine the difference between hard-boiled eggs and fresh eggs.
And here on Earth, I did this experiment this week for our video pick, and the hard-boiled eggs spin a lot better here on Earth anyway.
They do. They do. And for the video that we had talked about earlier, I had given a number of examples of rotating bodies and how they behaved. And in the course of these examples, I would give the audience enough information so they could figure out for themselves what would happen to the chicken eggs. And have we decided, are we going to tell them what the answer is, or are we going to let them try to figure it out themselves?
No, this is a puzzler. When you told me that I couldn't give away the answer when we talked earlier this week, I took it seriously. So we've put this as a challenge to our listeners, since that was your stipulation.
Okay, well, cool. That's good. We will give them enough information with all these other rotating bodies that if they pay attention, they could figure out what's going to happen.
Yeah, there are some clues. I think we walk people through it pretty well. Although, so what we're asking, if you watch the video on our website, which has the eggs spinning, is to tell us the difference, which egg is which is hard-boiled and which isn't. And then, here's the kicker, though. Then explain why you
Ooh,
think
that's
that.
That's always the rub.
Yeah, right. It was for me in physics.
And you see, this is an example that space is really a frontier. Our normal intuition on Earth doesn't necessarily apply when you go into this radically different environment. And so the answers are not in the back of the book. If you go to various textbooks on physics and things, I doubt if you'll find the answer to what's going to happen to these space colonists with their chickens and their eggs mixed up in a weightless environment. And so this means that when you do go off to these frontiers, these are places that are rich in discovery, which I think is one reason why we go off to frontiers in the first place.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato with Flora Lichtman talking about eggs in space with astronaut Don Pettit.
Dr. Pettit, what are there other examples where you felt like your instincts were surprised when you were up in space? You know, things that you thought that just brought home how gravity-centric we are?
Every day, you can't hardly turn around and look at something without realizing how gravity-centric we are. For example, you lose something. Say you have your glasses, and of course, it's hard enough to keep track of your glasses here on Earth, but you could imagine in a weightless environment, you stick them with a dot of Velcro on the wall, and then you turn around and they're gone. And I found I instinctively would look at my feet, because that's what
sure.
Earth intuition trains you. If you drop something, you look down at your feet. And of course, that's not the answer to this equation when you're in a weightless environment, because they might be floating over the top of your head.
Is zero-G, is a weightless environment a good place to do these science experiments in?
Well, it's a different kind of place. So think about, a lot of science is done when you either create a new environment or invent a new tool. For example, when you invented the telescope, all of a sudden you could look at the planets and you could see that they had moons and that the moon, our moon, had craters, and you could learn all kinds of things that you couldn't learn without the telescope. And same things with microscopes. Well, space is just another place in which to do experiments where you can do them in an environment where you are weightless, and this is just one more knob, so to speak, that you can tweak and do experiments and see what happens.
I mean, and this is the thing that you see in the video. There are all these examples of, you know, you talk about the textbook. So we start with a textbook rotating, and you said that you saw this, that people would do this in class, but it would be a lot quicker, right? Because you could watch it in slow motion in space. It's spinning
around. And I need to point out that the textbook that I had, and this was on Expedition 6 in 2002-2003, I could fly one book, and the book that I decided to fly was a book written by one of my former professors, Octave Levenspiel, at Oregon State University, and he wrote a book called Understanding Thermodynamics.
That is the badge of geekness. Benji, what we call Benji now. A true Benji moment is that if any book you could choose, you took. What was the name of that book?
Understanding Thermodynamics. And mind you, it isn't just thermodynamics. It was Understanding Thermodynamics, which is a big difference.
A level above.
Tell me about it.
But it turns out to be really useful because you never know when you might be in need of a different variant of the first law of thermodynamics. And just, for example, when you're on space station, the only reason you can be there is because you have all these machines that make things for you, like air to breathe, and they dehumidify the atmosphere, and they'll recycle water so you can drink it. And inherent in all of that engineering is thermodynamics.
Are you headed back anytime soon?
I am headed back in December. So next month, I pack up my bags, and I go to Star City, Russia. And from there, I go to Baikonur, which is in Kazakhstan, and I will launch on a Soyuz rocket currently slated for December 21st.
Any quick previews of an experiment you plan to do while you're up there?
Oh, I've got a number of things, but one that I'm really curious about what's going to happen. I'm going to make a large sphere of water about the size of my head, and I'm going to anchor it with a little bit of wire so it'll stay in front of the video camera. And then we have MP3 players that, and we can uplink various music we can listen to. Well, instead of bringing a book on thermodynamics this time, I have these music files that are all these different sine wave tones from 60 hertz all the way up to about 400 hertz. And so I can listen to a pure 220 cycle tone if I wanted to, which of course is pretty boring, but I could play this mm-hmm. through the little earphone that I stick next to this big sphere of water.
And I want
to see whether I can drive some really neat oscillations in this sphere of water from these pure tones from my little MP3 player.
Oh, I can't wait for that video. Thanks. Thanks, Dr. Pettit.
We'll talk to you maybe while you're up there in space, hopefully.
Possibly. That can be arranged.
All right. We're working on it. And we have a prize for the right answer, don't we?
Yeah. Email us at egg@sciencefriday.com, and you can really geek out with an autographed pocket protector from Ira.
Wow. And that's about all the time we have today. Go to our website. All the details are there. Our program senior producer is Ned Heiss. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata, Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato was our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. And Neil Rausch is at the controls here in New York and doing our technical direction. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel, with a look back now at some of the big events in politics in the past week. And joining me, columnists David Brooks of the New York Times is in the studio, and today from Cambridge, Massachusetts, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post. Welcome back to both of you.
Good to be here.
Good to be with you.
And it's not every week that the Justice Department and the FBI accuse a foreign power of plotting an assassination on U.S. soil. They said Iran planned to kill the Saudi ambassador to Washington. And Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, said that wasn't all.
The Saudi ambassador's assassination was allegedly intended to be merely the opening act in a series of lethal attacks cooked up by the defendants and their cohorts in Iran.
Now first, David Brooks, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I'm coming to the conclusion that the jobs are obviously going to be a big issue in this election, but Iran will be close. A major issue in this election. I say that because of a series of interviews I've had with defense and intelligence officials, and you can see the uptick in concern they have about Iran, not only by actions about this, but they say, first of all, the Iranian nuclear program is back on the fast track and will likely to come to fruition within a year. That is before the election. Second, they say the Iranian leadership, such as they understand it, seems to have no brakes. Third, they say the Israeli leadership, there were generals and other people who were restraining Bibi Netanyahu from attacking Iran, mm-hmm. and a lot of those generals have been retired or been replaced. And so they look at the Iranian situation, and they see all the brakes coming off. And so you've seen this upsurge in concern about Iran surpassing Afghanistan, surpassing Pakistan. So this is part of that larger picture.
EJ, what do you think? This could be the year of Iran?
Well, I hope David is wrong about all of that, because God help us if all of that turns out to be true. First of all, if you look at this plot, if you sent this in as a thriller plot, the publisher would just send you a rejection letter saying, how implausible is this? Which is, in a way, what makes it even more more scary. And I think that this will obviously, it has to strengthen the administration's hands with our allies. But I think that Iran also, the Iranian government, is very split internally. And I think one of the fascinating things that I hope we learn about this is, were there parts of the Iranian government involved in this? Was this, you know, the entire government that sanctioned this? I think it could set off some real internal problems inside Iran, too.
Let's go on to another matter. It appears that Washington finally found its point of consensus in economic policy. President Obama won approval from Congress for free trade agreements with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. That's taken several years of negotiating, both diplomatic and domestic as well. David, does it matter?
Yeah, I think it's an important bill, especially the South Korea part. It'll create jobs. It's a sign that there actually are functional relationships between the White House and Capitol Hill. I asked some senior administration people, you know, can you guys actually talk to each other still? And they say, yeah, on some issues we can still talk to each other. So that's sort of a good sign. If you take the trade bill and the patent bill, which passed a couple months ago, those are actually, they're kind of wonky, but they're actually quite important for the economy. And so they're good things. And the Obama administration is very proud they got trade along with this trade assistance to help the workers.
But EJ, there were some Democratic voices saying that the trade agreements will cost more jobs than they'll add. Is there still a strong pro-labor, anti-free trade bloc in the Democratic Party?
Well, you bet there is. And some of these votes were the largest share of the Democratic House ever to vote against a trade agreement. The one that did best was the Korean free trade agreement, partly because I think it has important foreign policy implications in Asia, but partly because it was the one deal supported by the United Auto Workers Union. They thought they had gotten a decent break out of this. So trade is still very unpopular with free trade is still very unpopular with Democrats. But what this shows is that what the Republicans really want to pass, they can pass, which opens the question, well, why don't they pass the jobs bill, too, and let this comedy extend to a much broader field?
That was comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y. Yeah,
amen. Yeah, so we've had enough comedy up with the D already.
David, you're holding your breath for comedy on the jobs bill?
Yeah, they just don't fundamentally believe in it. You know, a temporary payroll tax deduction, I think, is the most likely to pass as a piece. But I'm not sure in this climate too many people are going to pass it. Think a temporary cut is going to lead to long-term jobs.
I want to play something for both of you. This is something that President Obama said in his speech in Michigan today. He was talking about his administration's decision to save General Motors and Chrysler.
We made a deal with the auto companies. We said, if you're willing to retool and restructure, get more efficient, get better, get smarter, then we're going to invest in your future because we believe in American ingenuity. Most importantly, we believe in American workers. And today, I can stand here and say that the investment paid off.
So here's my question. I'm truly puzzled by this. In dealing with the auto companies, President Obama rolled the dice to save, I believe it was said, 800,000 jobs in the upper Midwest. His policy was innovative. He thought big, much bigger than anything they've thought about the housing crisis, eh? He got sacrifices from stockholders, bondholders, auto workers, auto executives. It seems to have worked. And then voters in the very states that benefited from all this dealt the Democratic Party some of its worst defeats last November. First, David Brooks, what happened? Explain that one to me.
Well, I agree it was a successful policy, and as EJ might remind you, I didn't write that at the time. I thought it was a bad policy at the time. But I think people think it's unfair. They think that our capitalist system is based on the idea that you're tested in the marketplace, and those who succeed thrive, and those who fail don't. And there's a fundamental moral link between effort and reward. And I think while they might acknowledge the discrete benefits of this or that bailout, the idea of bailout seems to violate that distinction, that link between effort and reward. So they fundamentally are bothered by weakening that link, and they think it's unfair.
What do you think, EJ?
Well, David and I have disagreed fundamentally on this from the beginning. I was one of the world's only, outside of Detroit, enthusiastic supporters of this policy because I thought letting the Detroit-based auto industry go down and all of the ripple effects across the Midwest would have been an irreversible decision for our country. I think what's gone on here is the classic split, two political scientists, I love to quote Free and Cantrell, that Americans are ideologically conservative but operationally operationally liberal. They tend to say, we don't want government to do this or that. They want smaller government. But they actually like the fruits of what government does. They like the results of government policies.
But, EJ,
I have a hunch.
We only have a couple of seconds here. But in Ohio and Michigan and Illinois, the very places where the jobs were sold, Democrats were slaughtered last November.
And I have a hunch that between now and November of next year, this policy will look a lot better to those voters. And if Obama can't sell this policy in that part of the country, he's going to have a lot of trouble elsewhere.
EJ Dion, David Brooks, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.